Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Elise Lufkin about the wonderful new book, To the Rescue, Found Dogs with a Mission. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Marie-Hélène Cousineau. She is a co-writer and co-director of the film Before Tomorrow, which is screening tonight at 7:30 at the CCA in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a fascinating and beautiful film about an Inuit boy and his grandmother. It's set, as I understand it, in 1840. Tell us about the source for this story.
Well, the script of the film is an adaptation from a book called Before Tomorrow, I guess, but it's not translated in English. It's a Danish book by Jørn Riel, who is a man who lived in Greenland for almost 20 years. So his story took place originally in northeast Greenland. The women of Igloolik, my colleagues from the collective Arnait, and I wrote an adaptation taking place somewhere in the Canadian Arctic.
And so when you're recreating another time like that, you have to recreate, I mean, you're in the place, the Canadian Arctic, but you're recreating the stories, the language, the nonverbal body language, the way of thinking, you know, the pace of life, the tools, boats, all of it. How do you do that? How similar is what we see in the film to current day Inuit culture?
Well, it's very different. So actually making an historical movie, I guess it's an adaptation also. And, you know, there's a lot of oral tradition, you know, that are passed from one generation to the other. So my Inuit colleagues, Madeleine Ivalu, the co-director, and the main actress, and Susan Avignac, the co-writer and art director, know about the past as it was told to them by their, you know, mother and grandmother. And so, of course, there's something real, but there's also some fantasy, I guess, because you're right. It's like body language. That's difficult to know exactly how people used to stand, you know, and look at each other 150 years ago. There was no photos, there was no film, so, you know, the actors, you know, I mean, they have to play this. They have to talk between themselves and, you know, figure out those things. So that was, you know, a big part of, you know, creating this film is trying to put yourself in this mood of what it was to be living on the land 150 years ago.
It is so interesting to be watching it because you really, I mean, the suspension of disbelief is immediate and total. You are watching it and you're completely in 1840 pre-contact Inuit world. And of course you forget that there are, you know, actors and film cameras all around and things like that. But some of the things that I think are interesting just for us to learn about are just the way of life. Tell us about that way of life, what people ate, how they lived, what they did in the colder and warmer seasons.
Well, I mean, what you can see in the film, basically, because the film was shot over a period of four seasons, I mean, from June to January. So what you see is the spring and, you know, where people are picking up berries, they're fishing, they're walking on the land, going by boat and kayaking, to January, where the land is covered with snow and ice. And at that time, I guess, well, I don't want to sell the story. I don't want to tell the ending of the story. But, you know, if people were still in their camp, they would be still hunting, but by dog sled and hunting mammals and fish through ice and, you know, going caribou hunting, or eating what they caught and dry from the summer, so which is basically how the grandmother and the grandchild are surviving.
I just have to ask you, was it terribly cold when you were shooting in the Arctic in January?
It was pretty pretty cold. It was like minus 40, minus 45. You know, it was cold. That was the most challenging, I think, shooting period, because we had to travel from the village to our shooting place, and we were actually filming in a real cave. And that was really damp, and the actors were very brave, and, you know, we had a whole setup and a whole team to help us. And, of course, Inuit still know very well how to live on the land, so, you know, we never felt in danger or anything like that. There were tents, you know, with the furnace, we ate soup, and we warm up. But it was challenging to spend, you know, that many hours out there.
How did they, in this time, always have fire? How did they make and maintain their fires?
Well, what they do in the old time is that they would keep the fire going. They would carry it, you know, they would not extinguish it. And otherwise they would use, you know, rock flint to rub them together and, you know, make a fire like that.
The cinematography of this film is very interesting. It's very beautiful, but it's not that kind of giant Hollywood panorama landscape. And one thing that I thought was just amazingly beautiful and evocative was the shots that you did of boats from underwater looking up toward the sky at the bottom of the boats going by. They looked like sea animals. How did you develop the style of cinematography?
Well, I think the idea was, you know, that the, you know, there is legendary mythic goddess from the sea, Sedna, which is very important in Inuit mythology and legend. So we wanted to have the story sort of coming from the sea, you know, from the underground, it's not underground, it's undersea, I guess, to give it this mythical power, as if the story was coming from there and then going, you know, up to the ground and onto the sky. So that's how we sort of thought of doing some imagery underwater. And we had, you know, a small team, two divers with camera, went underwater and film. Actually, it took longer than we thought because it was kind of complicated. They were freezing. They had to stop, you know, every half hour they had to warm up. It's kind of cold water, but it worked pretty well.
You've been working for about 20 years with the people from this Inuit community. Tell us how that whole collaboration came to be.
Well, I moved in Iglulik in 1991, or beginning of the 90s, and I was involved in Montreal in filmmaking with community groups, and I was mostly interested in women's culture and women's stories. And when I went up north, I realized that there was a lot of, I would say, division between men and women in the sense that, you know, men were doing things together, women were doing things together, and of course they would collaborate, but it was easy to be just, you know, between women or between men. So I sort of fit into with the women and asked them if they would be interested in having a video workshop for them. And also, I think there were more men trained into video and television, and I thought it would maybe be a good idea to train women also. And that's how we started. They had a lot of stories to tell, and they really knew that using video or film, television would be a good way to reach a young audience. And being, you know, part of a oral culture, they felt very at ease by telling the story on video.
We're talking to Marie-Hélène Cousineau. The film is called Before Tomorrow. It's screening tonight at the CCA in Santa Fe. Talk more about the men's and women's roles. I was thinking about that while watching the film. For those women in the U.S. or Canada or Europe who've been involved in feminism, and then they take their feminist ideas up to a completely different kind of indigenous society, what do you see from your perspective, and how do you think those ideas work from theirs?
Well, I think, you know, I think I always ask them, you know, how do they feel? Do they feel like they can talk when the men are there? You know, do they feel as free to talk and say what they want to do? Do they feel supported in telling their story? And the answers from Susan and Madeline and, you know, the other women I work with was like, no, you know, we feel more comfortable if we are a group of women, you know, then we can talk and say what we want to be doing. So, and repetitively, you know, through the year, we keep asking the same question. And it was mostly like, yeah, we feel comfortable between us because, you know, we are, you know, giving values to our stories. And also we worked around their schedule, you know, we worked around, people have big families, they have a lot of family obligations, and we worked around that, you know, we went to their houses, we worked with children around, so that it was easier for them to participate in this artistic expression.
This film is part of a trilogy, and I'm assuming, although correct me if I'm wrong, that the people... the actors are not trained actors. Is that correct?
Actually, Madeleine Ivalou, the co-director and the lead actress, is not trained in the sense that she didn't go to acting school, but this is the third feature that she participated in, and she acted in other shorts. And, you know, she's also a co-producer for different documentaries that we shot through the year. So I guess she has experience. And the other women also who's acting in the film as her friend, the older women, acted in many other films in Canada and Russia. The little boy, that was his first time, you know, acting. And the secondary characters were also newcomers. But we made sure that, you know, I knew that Madeleine was able to carry the film on her shoulder because she's in every single scene, I think, of the film. So I wanted to make sure that she was able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, she's amazing, and the other actors are also, the other characters are played in such a natural way. What was it like to, I mean, you wrote the script, but I guess there was some conversation before it was shot where they really made it their own also?
Yeah, every day we had discussion about the script to make sure that they felt comfortable with their lines, they felt comfortable with what they had to say, and that the language was the right one. For Madeleine, it was very important that the Inuktitut, which is the language that it's, you know, it's spoken, was accurate, you know, that it was the right words were used. And so we went through the script mostly every day. But I mean, it's not improvisation. People just said anything. They really said what was, you know, written in the script.
And of course, a large part of it is also nonverbal, which one gets the sense as the viewer is a very important part of that society, that there's a lot that's said, but there's also a lot that isn't spoken.
Mm-hmm. There's a observation style into the camera work, you know, which allows the audience to really witness, you know, and be there with the people, which I guess, you know, helps to create this intimate style that you have in the film.
Tell us a little bit about the soundtrack. Did you use any indigenous musical instruments?
Well, the soundtrack is a combination of different things. There is original song by Madeleine Ivalou and Susan Avignac, which is the song that the grandmother is singing. There's also music by two French-Canadian, English-Canadian, I guess they're both, Kate and Anna McGarrigle, songs, which are, I guess, they recall the period at which this story would have taken place. They also are folkloric music, and they also refer to this Scottish music tradition, which would have been the music that the Inuit would have heard on the boats that were coming to meet them. There's also music made by Michael Reinhardt, which is a contemporary musician in Montreal, and he created some original score for the soundtrack. So it was important for us to have this combination of music.
When I was watching the film, it's very clear that the people whom you're filming and the larger community that they represent are still, you know, they know how to live off the land. They know how to hunt and so on. But what is their society like in terms of contact with the rest of the world? I mean, do they have TVs? I mean, what is it like?
Oh, right now they live in villages, you know, like in Alaska, made out of, you know, houses, and, you know, they have internet, television, they take airplanes, and, you know, they have the cable, and, you know, they're on Facebook. they're part of that culture, too. So that, I mean, the traditions are kept, not at the same level, depending on which community, and also, I guess, more of the older people know about their tradition than the young people.
It seems to me, and again, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it seems to me that in Canada, there are a lot of subcultures that maintain dual identities for many generations. Are the Inuit people maintaining both that kind of westernized, internet-connected identity and their Inuit past?
They're trying to. You know, it's not easy, but I guess they're trying to. I just, you know, spent last week in Iqaluit with a woman who's an Inuk hunter, and in the same time, she's fighting against uranium exploration in their region, and she's using internet, and, you know, she's whining when she doesn't have internet access. So, because she knows she needs it, you know, she needs it for her message. So she's part of this, you know, big world, but in the same time, you know, she's wanting to keep her feet in their traditions because hopefully it's possible to do both in some way.
The film illustrates in a number of ways the central importance of storytelling to human beings. And I was thinking about that. There's this moment where, we're not going to give away the story, but where there's a difficult period and one of the characters says, when we are out of this, we'll have a lot of stories to tell. And you know, compared to, who knows what the wolves or the ants are doing, but it seems like we're this special species that tells stories, and that is so important to us. And I was thinking that the film itself not only contains stories, but it's a story that the Inuit people you're working with are telling to the rest of the world.
Yeah, I think it's really a film about the importance of telling each other stories. And I guess that's what we do. You're right. As human beings, that's what makes us different, you know? It's like that's what we used to survive, basically.
There's a depth to the spirituality that we see in this film, and it's hard to describe. And in a way, I'm not even sure how much we can talk about it. People will just have to go see the film tonight. But how would you describe the spirituality that you portray in that film?
How would I describe the spirituality?
Yeah.
Well, I don't really want to describe it, but I think that there's, you know, I think we'll let, you know, people find out for themselves. But
yeah.
I think there's a strong sense of, you know, there's a strong sense that there is more to the reality than what we see, you know, basically. And,
Marie-Hélène Cousineau is the co-writer and co-director of the film Before Tomorrow, which is screening tonight at 7:30 at the CCA in Santa Fe. What is next for you?
Well, right now we're finishing a documentary that's going to be basically on the web. It's about the reaction of people in the northern contemporary setting to the mineral exploration and exploitation of Nunavut, which is going, I would say it's going crazy, you know, because it's a very rich territory, and now with global warming, you know, it seems like the territory is going into mining development more than, you know, any other place in Canada, or one of the place where it's going the strongest, you know, in the world. So we're working on this because that's a big concern for people to keep their life, their tradition, their territory, their environment, and by consequence, their stories. We are also, I'm working on writing a script taking place in a community right now, not a historical film, but a film that would take place, you know, in a contemporary village in Nunavut. I'm not going to say more about that one. It's a big challenge to write it.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and we look forward to seeing the film tonight and seeing more of your work as it comes out.
Okay, thank you. I suggest you go on the internet and check us out on Isuma TV, isuma.tv, ISUMA.tv, and you'll find more of the work we do.
Excellent. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Elise Lufkin. She is author of the new book, To the Rescue, Found Dogs with a Mission, and she will be speaking tomorrow evening at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be back.
It's wonderful to have you. This is a similar format to the last book that we talked about several years ago, which was about rescued dogs getting second chances. So it's written by the dog owners themselves, who in this case are people who have found or rescued dogs in some way, and those dogs have come, and one cat, have come to be helper dogs or therapy dogs of some kind. How did you come across the subject and all of these stories?
Well, the subject developed naturally really from the other books. My first two books were, as you said, stories about rescued dogs, concentrating more or less on the way that they enhance the life of the rescuer, because I'm very, very interested in the idea that an animal that's considered a disposable, like an old Kleenex, and just tossed away by somebody can go on, and if he's given a second chance by someone else, can go on to really, you know, give back so much and add so much to that person's life. And then this last book just took it a step further. I had, in the other books, we had touched on service dogs and therapy dogs and, you know, dogs that worked with people in wheelchairs. There's a seizure alert dog in one of the books, and one of the Second Chances, I think, has a story about a dog that alerted when his owner had angina attacks. And so I was very, very interested in that idea that people not only will rescue an animal, and it's a lot of work, you know, basically some more than others, but some of them need considerable amount of time and attention and obedience training and reassuring before they really are comfortable sharing a person's life. And, you know, you have all the medical issues, if there are any. You have feeding and taking, you know, general care. But these people have taken that, and I think very often by the time you get a dog to the point where he's comfortable in your life and you're happy to have him there, you really feel you're happy to relax and enjoy that dog. And these people do relax and enjoy their dog, certainly, but they've elected to take the whole thing a step further, where they've done further training with their dogs, whether it be for just general obedience in order to be able to take them to hospitals or nursing homes or places like that, or whether it's to train them in search and rescue, or whether it's to train dogs to, you know, to work for someone with a disability. I have some hearing dogs and dogs that work with people in wheelchairs and things like that, and it just seemed to me such an extra generous gift that these people have been willing to give, not only to the dog, but also to the world, or not to the world, I mean, that's much too grandiose, but to people. whether they're being visited in the hospital or whether they're getting a service dog, which can change their lives.
It really amazes me how people are able to adopt a dog that is really, you know, you might call it a bad dog or a terribly sick dog, and work with that dog to rehabilitate it to the point where it's a normal, happy dog. It really takes a special, I mean, I was trying to imagine myself doing that, although I've certainly adopted some sick dogs, but people really go the extra mile for these dogs who they didn't even know two days earlier.
And it's been one of the most exciting things about writing these books is to see that just tremendous generosity of spirit, because I think we all get bombarded with so many stories of cruelty and of neglect and abuse and all the terrible things that are going on in the world, but it's just so reassuring to know that at the same time there are these wonderful, generous, kind people who are, you know, really doing a lot. And then, of course, once they, it's not just a question of training your dog to be able to take him to a hospital, but then you have to actually go to the hospital. And so people, you know, are adding big chunks of time into their weekly schedule to go and visit with the dog or go and do search and rescue work or training with the dog or things like that, then that's on an ongoing basis. There's a woman in To the Rescue, Billy Peters, who's in her 80s, I think her mid-80s even, and Billy rescues racing greyhounds, and she takes those dogs 3 or 4 days a week. She takes one of them to, in one case, one goes to a nursing home, one goes to a reading program at a library, one goes to a veteran's home. She has other, you know, places that like her to come and visit, and she's out and about and, you know, doing things, reaching out to people and helping people and taking her dogs out to comfort people every week.
Tell us the story about the person who adopted a deaf dog that then went on to work with deaf children.
Oh, yes. Cooper is a dog. He's a Labrador, and he came, he was abandoned. I can't remember how he was abandoned, but he ended up with a Labrador rescue group in Texas, and he just bounced from foster home to foster home, and everyone said he was perfectly sweet, but he just was just so difficult to train that he just seemed to tune you out, not to pay any attention, just very, very difficult. And then, lo and behold, on about the third home, they discovered that he was absolutely stone deaf and really couldn't understand what people were saying to him. And there was no way to have expected that he would be able to know what sit means unless you gave him a hand signal or showed him or something. And he ended up being fostered by a woman who is a teacher for deaf children, and she fostered him and was going to just keep him, of course, for a little while and teach him, train him on hand signals and get him started. And then, of course, she fell in love with him, and so she ended up keeping him. And she takes him now with her to the classroom when she works with these deaf students. And she has taught him American Sign Language, and the children just get a huge kick out of practicing a American Sign Language on him. And one little girl that he visited said, "I love Cooper because he's so sweet and because he's deaf like me." So and the dog just goes along and seems perfectly happy, which I think is another thing that you see often with dogs that visit people in hospitals too, that if you have a dog with a disability, that the dog is usually quite happy and goes along with his life, and it's an inspiration to people that he visits who say, "Oh, well, you know, if Linus can get along on three legs, maybe I can work with whatever disability I have."
Right. And I learned from that how important it is when you have a deaf dog that the dog always has a member of the pack in sight. So when that dog was crated out of the room away from its owner, it went bananas. But as long as he could see its owner or at the very least see another dog or a person, then the dog was okay, because that's how he communicated with the rest of the world, was
exactly,
visually.
That's exactly right. And the person who adopted him said that he just went crazy, as you say, but she said she suddenly realized that it was as if you had taken someone and put them in solitary confinement, because he didn't know what was going on in the house. He didn't know where anybody was. And so she always had a rule that when she first fostered a dog, that it would stay in the laundry and be somewhat quarantined from the rest of the family. But she realized with this dog that she couldn't do that. So she moved the crate right into her living room or her bedroom, but somewhere where he would be able to see everybody and everything that was going on, so that even if she wasn't at home, he could see the other dogs. And he was completely reassured by that, and it made a huge difference. It's just part of that thing, I think, about communicating with animals, that you really have to make an effort to try to see the world the way they are seeing it, not the way you might necessarily think it would be.
There was a dog named Mandy that was a little, I think it was a Cocker Spaniel, that was adopted by a woman who ended up working with kids with this little dog. And one of the things that was striking, and I think this happens a lot, is people adopt dogs who are just like them. She said, I'm going to read it. She said, "Mandy and I are kindred spirits. I was almost made a ward of the court when I was 15. But with a chip on my shoulder after abuse by multiple family members, I ran away from home instead. No one admitted the abuse till years later. Meanwhile, the dog had repeatedly been rejected and returned to the shelter, and no one had taken the time to understand the dog. And she and that dog got along perfectly. And when you look at the portrait, every one of these stories has a portrait with the dog. They look exactly alike."
I know, it's very funny. It's a very pretty blonde woman.
And right.
A sweet blonde Cocker Spaniel with a big smile on
with
the
same exact facial expression.
And the Cocker Spaniel actually has a pink tutu on. I'm not sure you can see it in the photograph.
Oh, my goodness.
She dances. She goes to a school for developmentally disabled children, and she dances for them.
Amazing. We're talking to Elise Lufkin about the new book, To the Rescue, Found Dogs with a Mission. Now, some dogs in the book are search and rescue dogs, or dogs with a real job. One of them is a cadaver-finding dog working with an FBI agent, and there are some others. Tell us about some of these dogs.
Yes. Bailey, the cadaver dog, works for someone who worked at who was actually working at the Pentagon on September 11th, and she just had gone off her shift when the plane struck the building. But she, in the meantime, had this beautiful golden retriever who had been a sadly neglected dog, and she managed to adopt him, and she had trained him in search and rescue. She had another dog, worked in search and rescue. And she took both those dogs and searched at the Pentagon. And it's a tremendously important work, cadaver search, because it really helps the families of the people who are lost with some kind of closure. I mean, it's very sad work, but it's such an important part. And Eileen Romer, the FBI special agent, said that she had seen in her work, she did a lot of work with cases of abducted children. And she said she saw very, very clearly in that work how important it was that even if the worst happened and the child was not recovered alive, that at least for the family to know that the child had been found and to have some kind of closure was really very, very, very important. And this dog, and of course to a dog, it's all in a day's work. A dog doesn't really care, I don't think. I don't know. Anyway, a dog mostly is interested in the game of searching and whether he's looking for marijuana or cocaine or bombs or bed bugs. I have some bed bug dogs in the book. It's a game, and you get a reward, whether it's praise, food. Often it's a game. It'll be a tug of war or a ball or a toy or some favorite toy, something like that. And it's all part of a game, and that really was the way that dog worked. And then there are a couple of other, there's a pair of avalanche dogs that I talk about in the book also that do very much the same kind of work. The only thing there is they're trained to work in the snow and to dig and, you know, all that kind of thing.
When you read the book, you think about how, just like some of us are temperamentally suited to certain jobs and not others, it's the same with dogs. And they have to be tested along all kinds of criteria to see whether they can even go into some of these job programs.
Absolutely. And there's a wonderful woman in Florida who has really made it's not her actual work, she's a psychologist, but in her hobby really is going to animal shelters and the people in the shelters near her around, I think she's around Tampa somewhere, actually look for dogs that might be suited for her. And she works very closely with a man in Texas who trains dogs for all sorts of bomb detection and things like that. And it's one of the things that they look for is a very high play response, a very strong ball motivation. So sometimes it's the kind of thing that may have driven the original owner crazy. You know how some dogs are just so fixed on balls that they'll just drop the ball at your foot 8 million times in the day. And
right.
That's what they look for, because that's so, so helpful in training the dog. And she has saved a lot of dogs that way. She also looks for dogs that are potential service dogs to work with people in wheelchairs and people like that. There is a dog, Sunny, in this book who works with a woman who has a bone disease and has never really grown. She's about 30 inches tall, and she's 24 years old. She's a pharmacist student. And this dog was found in a shelter. Or no, he was found by the side of the road, actually, but he turned out to look as if he was going to be a good kind of companion dog. And so Natalie has found literally hundreds of dogs that have then gone on and been placed with either as service dogs or as some kind of working dog that has worked in with the police or with, you know, there's an arson detection dog in the book. And she really, just goes, that's what she does. And the ones that don't make it, she usually takes them for a few weeks and figures out which way is the best way for them to go. But the ones that don't actually make the grade to go to Texas or to go on to a place that trains service dogs, she almost always finds homes for them, because usually by the time they've spent a few weeks with her, they've learned a lot of manners and
right.
She's figured out what makes them tick, and they're adoptable suddenly.
It also goes to show that so many dogs really want a job. Some of them are happy to follow you around and be couch potatoes and stuff and just take their daily walk, but many of them, I know I've got two terriers that I know they love me, but they would be much happier if I were ranching rather than reading all day. But anyway, look, what about the therapy dogs who go to hospitals? What are the criteria? What do people look for in them as temperamental abilities?
Usually, one of the first steps, what you would look for is a dog that's comfortable with strangers and, you know, is fairly calm. Usually, they will have passed a good canine good citizen test, which basically means that they can, you know, that they can walk on a leash, that they can approach a person, or they can approach a person with a dog, and they can sit quietly and wait until they're asked to move forward, that they can sit and lie down and come when they're called. And I mean, they'll always be on a leash when they're at work, but it's very important, one, that they're calm around people, two, that they're calm around other dogs, and three, that they're pretty obedient. And then usually, for instance, the Delta Society, which is one of the certifying groups, they often will have training sessions that you can sign up for, and then you do a certain amount of time, you know, working on things that the dog will help the dog to pass the certification test. And also they train, and all the good organizations also spend quite a lot of time and effort on training the person, training the handler, talking about, you know, ways to talk to people, the importance of not getting involved in the politics of the nursing home, or, you know, just sort of basic things and things, just ways to approach people. And then, of course, there's so many different situations, and dogs are certified usually at different levels. For instance, my old terrier was certified at a fairly low level, she was fine. She was great for nursing homes, and she did it and loved it, and they loved her. She would not have been good, much more demanding, or is anything that involves small children, because they're so unpredictable and so much in perpetual motion. And some dogs, you know, do very well with that. They're fine, but they often, they would, to go to a facility with children, you would have, your dog would have to have a more complex rating than a dog that could go, say, to a nursing home or to a hospital where everything was fairly straightforward.
There are some dogs that just take to their therapeutic role instantaneously, and they know just what to do and who to talk to and who to lick and whose bed to sit by in a way that seems almost uncanny.
It is, but I think that dogs, having lived with people for so long, are very tuned in to people, and I think that dogs work very much from body language and facial expressions and nonverbal cues. So I think that they are tuned in, and I mean, it's one of the things that the handlers say over and over again, that their dog just really surprises them sometimes with his sensitivity in terms of knowing what's required. It's very interesting. I can read you the part about Dixon, I think.
Yes, Dixon, this little dachshund. Yes,
Dixon,
please do.
The dachshund, who started out actually with having had the first, I don't know how many years, first 7 years of his life, he lived with someone who had no time for him, and he was just left alone all the time. And when Karen Kirchner adopted him, he just really wasn't very interested in people or hadn't met other dogs, wasn't used to other dogs. And she worked with him for a long time. I think she went through three complete sessions in dog school. She said it was about their 23rd class before he started to figure out that she was telling him something, that if he responded, that treats were involved, and that he really made that connection. But then he went on and finally got certified and did a lot of hospital visiting at Cedars-Sinai and also at the Henry Mayo Memorial Hospital, I think, in Santa Clarita. And anyway, one of the stories that Karen told me was about a Saturday afternoon. I'll read this to you. Dixon and I, and I'm speaking in Karen's voice, because all these stories are narrated in the voice of the person who has the dog. On a Saturday afternoon, Dixon and I went to the room of a young man I'll call Peter, who had requested a therapy dog. When Peter first saw Dixon, he seemed disappointed. He had wanted a bigger, fluffier dog. I offered to leave and get him signed up for the type of dog he preferred, but he decided that Dixon would do in a pinch. When I put Dixon on the bed, Peter complained that he wasn't effervescent enough. Again, I offered to leave and look for someone else. And again, Peter said Dixon would do. At that point, Peter's visitor asked if I would mind staying in the room while he went to get a quick cup of coffee. After his friend left the room, Peter began to hallucinate and started to call Dixon Rusty. I learned later that Rusty was Peter's childhood dog, a golden retriever. Peter said, "Rusty, I've missed you. Come to me, Rusty." Tears were streaming down his face. Then Dixon did something I have never seen him do. He wriggled up Peter's side and buried his muzzle in Peter's armpit. The tears continued, but a smile appeared as well. "Rusty, you haven't forgotten. I love you, boy." Dixon started moving his muzzle around, tickling Peter. Peter let out loud, racking sobs mingled somehow with joy. "Rusty, you know what I like." When Peter's visitor returned, Dixon and I left to visit our other patients. I could hear Peter talking to his memory of Rusty as we walked down the hallway. After we completed our visits, I decided to return to Peter's room. He was gone, his bed stripped. A nurse told me that Peter had passed away a few minutes after Dixon and I left. It's the sadness of seeing someone so young reach the end of his life broke my heart, but I knew that Dixon had helped Peter feel that he was leaving this world with his beloved Rusty at his side. So that's certainly an example, I think, of what you were talking about.
Yeah, amazing,
in terms of a dog really sensing what what will be helpful.
The very next story in the book is equally moving, and I mean, I get choked up just thinking about it, about a dog named Ceres who ended up working with children who were terribly abused, who had parents who were drug addicts and things like that. And this dog could do, and a lot of dogs, it turns out, can do things that the most compassionate teachers and counselors are unable to do, which is give them a sense of self-esteem.
I think that's absolutely true. And Ceres had had a very rough start. He was an abandoned dog, and he was adopted by a woman who loved him and worked with him, and then she started taking him to the Valley of the Moon Children's Center with working with abandoned, abused, and neglected children. And in the end, as you say, six-year-old Joey, this is one story of many with the work about the work that Ceres did with these children. Six-year-old Joey did not feel very good about himself. Like many children, he thought that he had been sent to the children's center because he was a bad boy. He ignored the teacher's attempts to reassure him. After his first class with Ceres and me, Joey wanted to pet Ceres. So another student volunteered to tell him about the three rules for proper and polite dog greeting. After Joey first asked permission of the owner, me, he then asked permission of the dog by letting Ceres sniff his hand until Ceres stopped sniffing. And then third, Joey knelt by Ceres' side to pet him on the chest and neck. Ceres began to cover Joey's face and hands with kisses, something the dog had never done before. I said, "Joey, Ceres loves you so much, you must be a very good boy." "No," said Joey, "I am not a good boy. I'm not good." I replied, "You are a good boy, Joey. Ceres knows, and he doesn't make mistakes about important things like that." But Joey couldn't believe me, so he said, "Can we ask Ceres?" Now, all the children know that Ceres can answer questions. One bark for no, two barks for yes, and three barks for maybe. Ceres has never once disappointed me by giving an inappropriate answer to any question from a child, and he refuses to answer private or mean questions. He is very good at reading body language and even thoughts and feelings, so I was not worried that he might give the wrong answer to this critical question. Makes me nervous just to hear about it.
I know.
To go on with the story, we asked Ceres, "Is Joey a really good boy?" And Ceres spoke up with a loud and clear voice, "Bark, bark." That means yes. There was no mistaking what he said and how loudly he said it. Little Joey stood up tall and straight and swaggered off, saying, "If Ceres says it's so, it must be true." I gathered up my dog supplies and left the room, choking back some tears. I saw a little boy's faith in himself restored by a brave therapy dog who had once been abandoned and abused, just like his friend Joey.
The book is called To the Rescue, Found Dogs with a Mission by Elise Lufkin, and photographs by Diana Walker. We've just got a minute or two left. Tell us about how all these portraits of the dogs were taken. And it really is striking. I mean, they really are portraits of the dogs and not of the dog owners.
That's true. And often they're portraits, I think, of the dog's work. That's
right.
Really what Diana was trying to do. Diana, for many years, was Time Magazine's photographer at the White House. So she's had many, many years of photographing presidents. And when I started the dog books, I asked her if she'd be interested in working on this project. And she has done photographs for all three of the books. And they really are wonderful, wonderful portraits. And they just explain the stories in a great way. And we had a lot of fun traveling around and figuring out what stories could, what pictures could help tell the story.
Elise Lufkin will be talking about her book, To the Rescue, Found Dogs with a Mission, tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Elise, thank you so much for this wonderful book and for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. May I just add quickly that the book signing will benefit the Santa Fe Humane Society and also Assistance Dogs of the West. A portion of book sales will be donated by the bookstore to those organizations.
Yes, I'm so glad you mentioned that. And thanks to the wonderful Dorothy Massey and her daughter Mary for making that possible as well.
Yes, wonderful.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe radio cafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.